everybody. Jan Rutherford here with Self-Reliant Leadership. Thanks for joining me today. Really excited. I've got a couple of things for you today. A short, very short presentation on the solitude of leadership, leadership lessons from crucible expeditions. And we just got back a couple of weeks ago from Moab, Utah and Dominguez Canyon, Colorado. And I've got a special guest joining me who was a participant on the crucible, Julie Keller from Baker Hughes, who is a big sponsor of our crucible this year. So we'll bring her on in a minute. In the meantime, whatever questions you've got and comments, please put them in and we will try to get to all those as we can. And let me just go ahead and get started. I've got a lot of interesting information to cover with you, I hope. And the first reminder is the whole idea that self-reliant leadership is really built on three pillars. And the first one is leading yourself, which really has to do with you taking personal responsibility and ownership for your own development. And oftentimes that implies that there's some grittiness going on, persistent and sustained determination. We often think of leading others as a real true measure of leadership. And this is about oftentimes accountability, you know, making sure stuff gets done. But I think the best leaders really bring out loyalty and a sense of duty to each other so that actually their job is easier because people are really watching out for themselves. And the third thing, the hardest thing in my mind, is leading the organization, which is all about alignment between different various teams. And this really requires a lot of focus. So I'm going to talk about how these things tie together. And I see we've got a whole bunch of folks joining us from all the way from India, all over the world, from the Congo. Welcome, welcome, welcome. All right. So getting back to how these all tie together. When we're out on these crucible expeditions, the first thing we do is we assign a leader and we say, you know what, we're at point A, we need to get to point B. And Jihan is basically saying she can't hear me. If the other people can hear me, let me know. If anyone else can't hear me, let me know in the chat. That would be great. But hopefully you can hear me. But connecting the pillars is about really the leader in the organization and on the team, on the crucible, on these expeditions is basically saying, I'm at point A and I need to move to point B. In the business world, most of the time, the direction is pretty straightforward. I'm here, I need to be there. So other people are saying they can hear, okay, and now you can hear me. Okay, good, good. Thanks, everybody. I appreciate that. I'm glad you can hear me. So again, going back, is the direction is oftentimes in the business world is pretty straightforward. Here's the objective. And the way that that looks like out on the crucible oftentimes is, you know, along the way, we've got obstacles, but we're trying to align the team and there might be ropes involved and there might be canyons and mountains and glaciers and different things. And of course, that's what's to be expected in the business world. There's going to be all kinds of things that we have to navigate around and be resourceful. And that really ties into the second thing, and that is pace. Well, if you think about it, out on a crucible, we can't go 3 miles an hour all the time. The terrain doesn't allow it. Physical abilities don't allow it. So we've got to figure out what's a sustainable pace. And think about the business world. You can't just look around cube land and say, you know, everybody's with me. And especially if you've got a hybrid workforce or remote workforce, how do you know everybody's keeping up with the pace? As an executive coach, I hear from senior executives all the time, I'm overwhelmed. I'm starting to resent this place. It's crazy. I can't do more. I'm working 60 plus hours a week. It's not sustainable. Well, of course it's not. Out on the crucible, we always say one thing, and that is our top priority is safety. The second priority is getting there. Well, you know, as long as organizations and teams and leaders are clear about the priorities, then you can make accommodations. For us, we can only go as slow or as fast as the slowest person. And as you can see in places we're at, sometimes we'll get to obstacles and it takes a while to get over. And we need teamwork. We need people helping each other. Sometimes we have really big obstacles to overcome and surmount. And the same thing applies in the business world. Now, the last thing that I want to hit on that really informs itself when we're out there is tone. Now, we think of direction as the head. You know, hey, here's where we're going. I've thought this through. The pace is the hands and the heart and the work that actually gets done. The tone is really all about how do I want people to feel when I ask them to do these really difficult things? And again, on our expeditions, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. Then we all go home. In the business world, there's no end. You know, if you hit your quarterly objective, then there's a next objective, and it's bigger and higher and harder. It's like going on an expedition, and every time we get to the top of a mountain saying, you know what, this was a high mountain, but now we need to go to a higher mountain. You know, is your team going to go, oh, or are they going to go, yes, we're ready to go take on that bigger mountain? Well, that's why tone is so important. How do you want people to feel when you're pushing them, when you're stretching them and not breaking them? And that's what's so important about leaders. And I think when we do this, when we do all these things right, when we set the right direction, we have the right pace, we set the right tone, then what we do have is a really high-performing team. And it manifests itself in the fact that they're adventurous. They're willing to take some risks, to be bold, to be vulnerable, to put themselves out there. They're selfless. They have a sense of duty to each other. You know, and on our expeditions, if somebody's tent's blown away, somebody comes in and helps you set your tent up. You know, at work, if somebody's working late, is somebody there saying, you know, why are you working so late? What can I do to help? It's a sense of duty, not just about yourself. The third thing is great teams, high-performing teams are driven beyond power and money to achieve heroic aspirations, to achieve the purpose for why the business exists in the first place, which hopefully is to add value to the client. That at the end of the day, it's not just a transaction that we can all say, hey, this customer that I serve is actually better off having done business with me. The fourth thing is that the team is dynamic, that you've got to slow down to speed up, that you've got to take time to reflect and assess the situation. But also out there, if you were with us on an expedition, you wouldn't really know at any given point who is the overall boss of the expedition, because everybody takes charge at different times. Sometimes the guides take charge when they help us with the ropes. Sometimes a leader that's been designated. Sometimes somebody has an insight that they want to provide. But the team is dynamic in that it's not hierarchical all the time. We really lean on the strengths of each other given different circumstances. And lastly, the team is protective. If you've ever seen a herd of elk in the wild and they're sitting down chewing their cud, they're all facing out. They all have literally each other's backs. It's safe. Well, a great team is, you know, they might be hard on each other and demand, you know, and this sense of duty and expect a lot, but boy, don't mess with any of my teammates. You know, they're competitive. You know, they feel duty bound to win in the market because they feel like they add more value than other people. But it's a safe environment. Again, to be your authentic self, to risk saying what you think. So again, to kind of recap from a leadership perspective, if we think about the head and setting direction, we think about the hands and the feet and setting a pace that's sustainable, and we think about the heart, you know, how do I set a tone where I've got commitment, not just compliance? Then I think we create a really high-performing team that can go beyond what we expected and accomplish great things. Now, with me on the last Crucible, I had the pleasure of having, who's become my friend, Julie Keller, with us. And Julie, welcome. Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Jan. Thanks for having me. So hi, everybody. Trying to make sure I get the right camera angle. And I apologize. I'm sitting at a restaurant outside of Boston where I'm on vacation this week. I needed a vacation from the crucible. So, thanks for having me. I am an HR director for Baker Hughes. I've been with the company about 11 years. I support a global sales function as well as a global product line for our business. So, it's a great pleasure to be here.
Yeah, and I'm just sending a note to everybody. Let us know your questions based on, you know, what the material I presented and the question and the any questions you've got. I'm posting that on LinkedIn. Hopefully everybody sees that. But just let us know whatever questions you've got. Again, we appreciate you being here with us today. Julie, so you came on this. Obviously, we took you out of your comfort zone. I mean, this isn't something that you do every day, you know, rope climbing and being in canyons and sleeping in the dirt and getting wind blown by 50 mile an hour wind gust. But as you reflect a few weeks hence, you know, what are the big takeaways that you remember from that experience?
Yeah, it is not something that I do every day, that's for sure. So I live in Houston, Texas, by the way. So the terrain of Moab was not something that I am used to walking on a daily basis. So there was a lot of physical stretch for me in terms of what we were doing. But I've been telling everybody that it was not just one of the most physically, difficult things I've done, but also mentally, Jan. And I think part of that is because of some of the things you described. You know, you're up on this mountain, you're up on a rock. What choice do you have but to keep going? You don't have a choice, right? So it was a lot of good moments for me to take a step back and tell myself, okay, this is the option. It's only one option. So how do you get over this mental hurdle to believe that you can do it? And that was for me such a good experience because I think that's so applicable in my everyday work, right? Things come up that are a hurdle on a daily basis. And it's easy to say, I can't do this, or we shouldn't do this, too hard. And that's not always the right answer, right? So it was a good reflection point for me of how often do I refuse to climb those mental hurdles? And how can I do that differently going forward?
Yeah. And what role did the peers that you had on the Crucible play in that, in helping you?
They were everything. I mean, I think I shared this on the last day. So, and for those who are unfamiliar, you kind of get paired up between, you know, one veteran on the, in the team, one, you know, business person. The veteran that I had the pleasure of being paired up with, her name was Liz, and she was just the most inspirational, kind of subtle, leader that I think I've ever worked with, or at least one of them for sure. She was so encouraging. She was patient. She was kind. She was helpful. I think all the things that when you take a step back and look at, you know, where do you find true leadership, all those same characteristics on this one, you know, sort of physically grueling event were, you know, incredibly important to me. So both, you know, she was my direct partner, but I would say everybody else in the team, similar responses. And the other thing that I think was just so interesting is how different strengths emerged in the group. And after the first day, you kind of fell into this rhythm of understanding what can this person bring to this particular moment, or what does this person help us achieve in this challenge? You know, very quickly we got sort of familiar with what the whole group could add.
Yeah, and it's interesting because what I observe is people are really willing to ask for help and to lend help. And in the business world, I see people willing to lend help, but I don't see people oftentimes being very vulnerable about asking for help. And I think that was interesting. Let me, we got a question. I'm putting it up on the screen. Hey, Julie, what do you think is the most demanded quality an organization looks forward to before giving a job? Good grades or personality? Please explain. I guess they're asking because of your HR background.
No, I think it's a great question. So the number one thing that I think makes a difference is being somebody who is teachable and coachable and someone that people feel like they can work with, right? So that's kind of three things, but they kind of tie together because most people want to help you. Like Jan was just saying, most people want to lend help. They want to know that it's going to be received and they want to know that it's going to be utilized. So when you go interview for a job or, you know, when you're looking at that next role, any way that you can show and demonstrate experiences where you've been coachable and teachable are, I think, just key. People want to work with people they want to work with. And part of that is you accepting the help.
Great. Yeah, question. In my simple mind, I always think, you know, there's three things. Can you do the job? Do I like you? Mm-hmm. Do you like us? I mean, I think that's what we're really trying to figure out at the end of the day. And
it isn't. Yeah. That last point you made also is important, Jan. I think people too often get anxious about landing a job and proving themselves, and they don't take enough time to think about, is this really where I want to be? Is this really an organization that fits with, you know, with what I believe in, and are these people that I actually want to work for, right? And you may get hired into a place that just really truly is not a fit for you. And I can promise that while you may feel urgent to land a job, it's much worse to be then stuck in a position where you don't feel like you can be yourself.
Yeah. Well, it's so important. And I was talking to a president of an organization today, and we were talking about culture and values and fit. And, you know, it's just so important to interview for those things. And again, if you're a young person, it can be hard and intimidating to do that. But part of it also, I say, is, you know, to ask yourself the question, for whose good do you serve? I mean, who are your people? Who do you want to work with? What kind of people? What are their interests? And what's the product, the service, the offering? And is that something that you can get passionate about? So let me throw another question up here. I haven't read it yet. Let me just read it real quick. Following the norms of social distancing, everything shifted to an online platform. According to you, what modifications are to be made to execute leadership online in the most effective way? So how do we lead online, hybrid and remote, and all that? That's a great hard question. That's not an easy one. What do you think?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I think has emerged as very important, both through the pandemic and then just as people have, you know, become accustomed to this very virtual world, which even though it's like you're just on one screen, you've sort of opened yourself up to people seeing your home, seeing your kids, seeing your pets, your partners, whatever it might be. I think one of the biggest, you know, changes in leadership that I've seen is caring about and incorporating people's lives more than we ever used to. And so I think a big piece of leadership is in a virtual world is recognizing that people have lives outside of the office. And also the numerous challenges that the pandemic and everything else has brought into their lives, and giving them the space and the support to manage in a totally different way than they ever used to. I think that's one of the biggest pieces that emerged. I'd love, Jan, to hear what you think.
Well, I appreciate that, Julie. And, you know, you were one of the people on the trip that was, I consider, a young person, you know, people in their 30s. And I asked, you know, what are you hearing? What are you seeing? And here's what I've heard over the last 6 months is people want freedom. They want flexibility. And they want purpose. And regarding purpose, they want an organization that's fiscally responsible, socially responsible, and environmentally responsible. And what I say is, if to the organizations, if you can offer all those things, awesome. If you can't, be unapologetic and say, here's what we offer, here's what we don't. so that you've got aligned expectations from the get-go. All organizations aren't going to be able to offer all things to all people. So I think you've got to be really straightforward in what the expectations are. You know, the other thing underlying all of this, you know, that I don't think gets talked about enough is hybrid work, remote work, work from home, all that stuff is at the basis of all this is fear and trust, you know. You know, on the employer side, they're afraid, you know, if they don't have control, you know, they're not going to manage things. Things are going to get out of control. They're not going to produce the results they want. And because of that fear, they don't trust. And then you know, the trust doesn't go both ways. I think we've got to get past that. We've got to figure out ways to trust people. We've got to give them more information and empower them. And again, you know, it doesn't mean we give them, we empower lots of people. I mean, we empower, you know, we give them big decisions to make right away that they earn, you know, levels of trust and responsibility over time. But it's complicated. And, you know, I think the discussion needs to be happening about what it means. And again, I go back to trust and fear. So we got another one here from Lynn Mulholland, a good Irish name. What if the culture, which was once a fit, changes dramatically and you are no longer a fit, even more isolated? This is a great, great question, Lynn. Julie, do you want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, sure. It's a great question. And I think that if this doesn't happen to you, if you're with a company for a long time and it doesn't happen to you, then you should examine your own, you know, personal progress, because you should be changing, you should be growing. That doesn't necessarily mean the organization is going to. So I think, you know, as a professional, you should constantly be making that assessment, whether this company is still a fit for you. And if it's not, don't be afraid to make the change. I mean, I think the most important thing in your work life is to feel like you belong, feel like you can be authentic where you work. And I can also promise you it's not as scary to change jobs as everybody thinks that it is, right? So, yeah. So I think, you know, don't be afraid to make that change. Now, if you're in a position where you can change the culture, then I think that's, you know, something that you want to examine as well. And if you are in a position to help, then you should take that opportunity. Sometimes, you know, you might be in that position and the company refuses to change with you, and then you have to make a change for yourself. So, yeah. I would just say again, don't be afraid, and don't be afraid to push the organization. I think we're in a much, you know, these days we're in a much more sort of employee-driven environment in a lot of ways. You know, I think years ago it was like you do the job, you take what you take the pay you get, you be happy and move on with your life. And I just don't think that that's the kind of corporate environment that we live in anymore. So, yeah. You know, push for the change.
Yeah, I think great insights, Julie. I think I always ask people, are you running from something or are you running to something? And what I ask them to do is evaluate their own values. You know, do you really know what you stand for, what you hold dear? How does that go up against the corporate values? And if they're not aligned, then you have to decide, you know, like you said, whether you try to change things, you have the power and influence, you know, and you're willing to do it, or it's no longer a fit. You know, as I also say is when we join a company, the day we join is we're a perfect fit, you know, but that doesn't mean that you stay a perfect fit for the company or vice versa. And, you know, I think the smart executives are the ones that know oftentimes when it's time to move on, when, you know, if that's the case. I think it's rare these days that somebody's going to spend 40 years at the same company. I know of one person who did that. One.
Yeah. I think that's also
Go ahead.
Sorry, just one other comment. I think that's also a very mature leadership decision. It when you recognize that you have done all you can do for the organization that you're supporting. And that doesn't necessarily mean you have to quit your job, but is it time to look at a different role? Is it time to look at a different piece of the business to participate in? There does come a point for every leader where you're not going to take it to the next level. That is just a reality. And I think it's a very mature thing to recognize.
Yeah. We got another question here. Lynn said, terrific insights. Thank you. So thank you, Lynn. Another one here, and I'll cut to the chase. It is basically, hey, I want to go for a job. I'm hesitant applying for these positions. This kind of reminds me of that Atlantic article that talked about the confidence gap from a few years back where, you know, if there's 10 requirements for a job, and again, I'm generalizing the article, if there's 10 requirements and a man sees that they meet 5 of the 10, they go for it. If a woman sees that and says, well, I only have 8 or 9 out of the 10, they don't go for it. And these two scholars that wrote the confidence gap article in the Atlantic basically said, you know, that this was the confidence gap, especially true with women, and that we need to go for it. I don't know if you're familiar with that article, Julie, but I'm wondering what your advice is for Afra.
I am familiar with the article, and I don't think I could have said it better, Jan. Go for it. I mean, there is no better advice than put yourself out there. The worst thing that's going to happen is you don't get the job. And guess what? You're not going to get the job anyway if you don't apply. So you'll be in the same position. And it's so true, Jan. You know, so often, especially women, and this is a generalization, but especially women will not go for the job unless they feel entirely certain that they can do it, that they meet the qualifications, that nobody's going to question whether they should be there. And that is not, again, a generalization, how men approach these things very often. So go for it. Be honest about where your gaps might be, but also have a plan of how you're going to overcome those gaps, right? And talk about that in your interview and just go for it.
Yeah. Here's another one. Can we share the link of the article by any chance? I can't do that and do what I'm doing right now. But I will tell you, it's the confidence gap, if you Google it, and it's in the Atlantic, and it should be free. But I don't remember, it's two women scholars that wrote the article, and I don't remember. So my apology for not having that at the tip of my tongue. Another question here was, this is a great one. How do you motivate team members to perform at their best level? And, you know, I'll kind of start on this one, Julie. You know, part of motivating people is setting out an expectation that people need to motivate themselves. And hopefully if they're passionate and driven and they have heroic aspirations beyond power and money, that you create an environment where people do their best. But if you feel like you've got to kick people in the butt, you're kind of wondering, do you have the right people? But part of it, you know, the short answer on how do you motivate people? Well, you have to figure out what motivates them. And the best way to find out is ask. You know, if I ask the CEO, what are you trying to get done? They're going to say, you know, hit my revenue goals. But if I really want to know, is hitting your revenue goals really what motivates you? No. What motivates them is winning, is being competitive. I mean, so if I appeal to their competitive nature, I'm gonna figure out how to motivate them. If I think all they care about is hitting revenue, that's just an outcome. So it's a really great question. There's an excellent article out there that was written way back in the 60s. And it's called One More Time, How Do You Motivate Your Employees? And in that, they talk about hygiene factors and intrinsic motivators. And I think it's a seminal article, and I really highly recommend it. And somebody did put in the link for the confidence gap. So thank you, whoever did that. I appreciate it. Julie, what say you about motivating from an HR perspective yes. and your own?
Yes, and sorry for cutting out there. My other phone, something happened. But
no
what I was thinking is, you know, right now, especially we, in basically all companies, are talking about inclusion and diversity. And to me, the inclusion piece is primarily about getting people to perform at their best, because when you feel like you belong to the group, you're much more likely to give more effort, more discretionary effort, and give a lot more to your job. So to me, the biggest way to motivate team members to do better or be better is to make them feel included. And how do you do that? Might vary by person, but one of the biggest things is get to know people, right? And get to know them on a personal level. Care about what they have going on personally. I've already sort of mentioned that, so you can see I'm pretty big on the topic, but the truth is
we've got you cutting out there, Julie. We got Julie cutting out just for a second. I'm just going to take her out of the stream and just for a second, hopefully her internet connection gets back better. Somebody just changing subjects a little bit. Somebody asked, and I really would love to see if Julie can get back in on this one. How, do you lead and manage a team of mainly women differently than a team of mainly men? My answer is, no. I manage performance the same way either way. So again, let me see if Julie can come back. Is she back? Nope. We lost Julie. And so again, I appreciate the question. I think that's a tough one, but let me just kind of go back and recap of what we've talked about. A lot of you have asked about motivating, about leading, about going for jobs. I think hopefully you've gotten some great input on those things. What I would ask you to remember is, I think the most important thing when you're setting direction, you're setting pace, you're setting tone, is that you really know what you stand for, what your values are, and that you're authentic. At the same time, I think what's really important to remember from a leadership perspective, and people realize it when they're on the crucible, is it's not about you. This whole leadership thing, it is not about you. It's never about you. It's about you being in the service of other people. So, part of what you have to do out on the crucible is you have to be squared away. You've got to have your stuff together, your backpack packed, your tent ready, your water. You have to be able to take care of yourself so that you can take care of other people. If you're not, then it's really difficult. Julie, one of the questions, and glad you're back. One of the questions was, do you manage men differently than women? A real easy question. I basically said I manage performance. Period.
Yes. Yeah. I was going to say you manage people differently. It's not about men versus women. It's about each individual's personality. And, the best leaders, in my opinion, flex their style to match the people that they manage. So it's not about gender. That may be a piece of it, but it comes down to how do you manage each individual? And it's going to be different.
Yeah. And somebody asked about, do female leaders lead differently than men? And I think if you said yes, you're stereotyping. I think people are people and they're strong leaders of all different types, not just diversity when it comes to gender, but all kinds of diversity of thought in different ways that people lead. I will say this. I love what I do, because part of what I do is I study leaders. And the reason I love it is because I know I'll never figure it out. I can look at leaders that I work with all the time and I'm like, what makes this person so effective? Because people are so different and yet they're effective in different ways. And again, I think the thing that I think you've got to be passionate about what you're doing. I think you've got to have that. And again, no matter you know, no matter how good your or bad your interpersonal skills are, if you have passion for something, some people are going to follow you. They're going to buy into that passion and that drive, because chances are that passion or drive is to make the world a better place in some way, shape, or form.
Absolutely agree. Absolutely agree, Jan. And leadership is ever evolving too, right? I mean, because people are evolving and communities are evolving and cultures are evolving.
Yeah.
Leadership has to as well. What worked 10 years ago may not work today. What worked, you know, last year. I mean, look at the pandemic, right? Everybody's world got turned upside down. Nobody had a playbook for managing through the pandemic. And those leaders who already knew how to adapt and flex and listen and make changes are the ones, I think, that emerged as the best leaders in that scenario.
Yeah. Well, hey, Julie, we're coming up on our time together, you know, kind of circling back to the crucible and this experience you had to digital detox and step back and filter out the noise and the cell phone and all that. When you reflect back on the exercise and what you learned about yourself and other people, what surprised you most about the experience?
I think what surprised me, the concept doesn't surprise me, but it surprised me how I learned it through the crucible. And that is just the absolute immense value of diversity, which I am a big proponent of anyway, especially as an HR professional, but just, you know, from a deep personal perspective, I love diversity. But I don't think that I could have survived the crucible without the various aspects that every team member brought to the table every single day. And it became tangible and real to me through that experience, just how huge of an impact people with different experiences, different perspectives, and different like willingness to jump in and do things, you know, became. It was almost like, not that we were ever in any real like life-threatening danger, but it was almost kind of like a life or death, you know, situation, drawing on the strengths of everybody in the team. So that concept of diversity and the power in diversity became extremely palpable to me, and I was so moved by it. I'd say that was the most surprising takeaway for me, and also how heavy of a pack I could carry. So that was the other takeaway. It was a great experience.
And there might be some questions that we're not getting to, and my apologies. I would ask you to connect, you know, send me a direct message if there's a question that you didn't get answered, and I'll be glad to do that. Julie, last question. And this is a HR topic. How did humor play a role in the crucible, and how does that relate to the work world?
Well, this is a very personal thing to me, because I try to approach everything with some amount of humor and perspective. I mean, you either laugh or cry. You either laughed or cried in the crucible at certain points, and I think laughter was the better method. You know, again, to me, it comes down to perspective, Jan, and really understanding and really prioritizing what's important in your life gives you that perspective. And to me, humor, fun, enjoyment, and caring about people is a huge, you know, driver for me. And so I think that, you know, we just have to keep some perspective when it comes to business, when it comes to life, when it comes to anything you're participating in. Keeping that perspective is so important.
Yeah. Well, I sure appreciated you being on the crucible. And coming and sharing that experience with us. I mean, you were just like you are on this video screen. You were always smiling. You were always laughing. And you know, I can't imagine doing anything, you know, without having, you know, a sense of humor and bringing that. And I think I shared with you all, you know, I'll know this is a good crucible if my stomach hurts so bad from laughing so hard. And it was. Hey, and with that, just a reminder to everybody, you know, today is coming to you via LinkedIn Live, and we've got a bunch of courses out there on LinkedIn Learning, And one we filmed last year out in the mountains of Colorado called Grit, how teams persevere to accomplish great goals. So if this is a topic of interest to you, I would recommend that you go there and check that course out. And again, I want to thank you, Julie, and I want to thank Baker Hughes for your sponsorship and your active participation in these endeavors.
Thanks, Jan. It was great, really great experience. Love being there. Thank you.
All right, everybody. Until next time, we will talk to you later.